You are listening to local and regional news produced by KMUN with help from our news partners. I'm Skylar Butenchen. It's Thursday, December 11th. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson has declared a statewide emergency following major flooding across the state. He is calling on the federal government to grant that request. If granted, the state emergency declaration would allow Washington to seek federal funds for recovery. Ferguson has also activated the National Guard to be positioned near Skagit County. The actions come after major rainfall associated with an atmospheric river dumped inches of rain in parts of the state in recent days and triggered historic flooding. In Pacific County, some areas have seen more than 8 inches of rain over the last 72 hours. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices voted to undo a rule tracing back to 1991, which recommended that all newborns receive the hepatitis B vaccine at birth. Shortly after, the Oregon Health Authority released a statement saying there was no credible evidence presented to support the changes, and that delaying the birth dose of hepatitis B vaccine will lead to more children and adults developing preventable liver disease and liver cancer. The new federal CDC guidance contradicts findings from the American Academy of Pediatrics, which says that there has been a 99% reduction in hepatitis B infections in children and young people since the original 1991 policy. Hepatitis B is a highly infectious virus that targets the liver and can result in potential cancer and death in extreme cases. U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. removed all members of the CDC's advisory vaccine panel in June. He replaced many of them with vaccine skeptics who have spread misinformation about the efficacy of immunizations. Then in September, governors of Hawaii, Washington, California, and Oregon created the West Coast Health Alliance in response to concerns about the independence and scientific expertise of the CDC. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has praised the alliance, saying it grounds its decisions in facts, data, and expert consensus. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. On Tuesday, U.S. House lawmakers voted overwhelmingly to renew critical funding for rural counties and schools, including many in the Northwest. OPB's April Ehrlich reports.
Dozens of Oregon and Washington counties have long relied on the Secure Rural Schools program to pay for schools, roads, and sheriff's patrols. But funding lapsed in 2023, and efforts to get a bill passed the House have failed three times. That changed this week, after most of the House voted to fast-track a bill to renew funding. U.S. Representative Cliff Bentz, an Oregon Republican, voted in favor of renewing Secure Rural Schools.
It provides a modest amount of funding for critical services, including infrastructure maintenance, search and rescue, fire prevention, and most importantly, money for children's education.
These counties include vast swaths of federal lands within their boundaries, lands that they can't collect taxes on. So the federal government historically shared its logging revenue. After logging declined in the 1980s, Secure Rural Schools replaced those timber shares, helping rural counties pay for public services while hosting the nation's public lands. I'm April Ehrlich, reporting.
Anderson Hay, based in Ellensburg, Washington, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The news is shaking the Northwest's agriculture and export industries. NWPB's senior correspondent Anna King has the details.
Gorilla and the industry leader. That's how other hay exporters describe Anderson Hay. Don Schilling is the president and owner of Wesco International. That's another hay exporter based in Ellensburg. He says U.S. exporters are hurting on the global market. High business costs, a strong dollar, and high hay costs are to blame.
And so some of these challenges, we either deal with them now or we're going to deal with them tomorrow. Hopefully, we can figure out a way to deal with them that doesn't have bankruptcy as the solution.
The case's next hearing is December 17th. I'm Anna King.
Up next is an episode from After the Fact, featuring the conservation efforts to protect the Pantanal and Gran Chaco in South America. Stay tuned after that for the Ship Report with Joanne Rideout.
We did this trip, and that includes a 7-hour ride in the car, and part of that ride in the car is snorkeling with your vehicle.
El Pantanal y el Gran Chaco representan vida, representan cultura, representan esperanza.
The Pantanal and Gran Chaco represent life. They represent culture. They represent hope.
It's an adventure. You have to be ready for an adventure.
Welcome to After the Fact. For the Pew Charitable Trusts, I'm Dan LaDuc. And in today's episode, we're taking you to South America. This part of the world is home to the planet's largest tropical wetlands. It's a landscape teeming with colorful birds, capybaras, anteaters, even jaguars. It's not the Amazon, which has faced deforestation and other challenges. We're heading to Brazil's Pantanal and Bolivia's Gran Chaco, where the ecosystem remains intact. So conservation is about preservation, not restoration. We begin with my colleague, Amelia Mora, who works on Pew's Conserving the Pantanal and Gran Chaco project. Amelia Mora, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Let's talk about those places in South America. I'm going to guess that a lot of people in the United States aren't as familiar with them. I mean, we think of South America and we think of the Amazon or Patagonia down in Chile. What is special about the Gran Chaco and the Pantanal?
They're really unique ecosystems. They're very distinct, but very complementary to one another. The Pantanal is the world's largest tropical wetland. If you think of wetland environments, a lot of times you think of flood control, and that is something that the Pantanal is really good at controlling. The Gran Chaco Forest is the second largest forest in South America after the Amazon. It's not a rainforest, it's a dry forest, and that means that it's adapted to periods of really hot and dry conditions. But then there are seasonal rains that come in. One of the benefits of the Gran Chaco is that it's able to regulate some of these climate actions via that seasonal water flow that happens in the Chaco. It's able to provide a consistent livelihood for those communities that are in the region, even when there are periods of dry conditions. There are also these really important considerations, including carbon storage, that happen in both ecosystems.
So two diverse places that sort of work together.
They work together because they're linked by water flows. And so if you picture the Pantanal, it's a floodplain, so a really low land area that's surrounded by these higher ecosystems. The rainfall that does happen in the Chaco will flow downstream and eventually end up in the Pantanal. So they're really connected by this flow of water.
You've been working on this project for Pew for several years, and you had mentioned to me before that you have Brazilian heritage. Have you had a chance to go down and see this place?
I sure have. I have the great pleasure of saying I've been to the Pantanal and now the Gran Chaco several times. It's been amazing.
Tell us about what it looks like.
We had a really amazing trip that I want to talk about this last May, and it was so special because we actually got to travel the entire Pantanal from north to south, where we got to see jaguars. We got to take a boat ride down to a very remote part of the Pantanal to be with these riverine fishing communities that fish for bait fish, which they then provide to recreational or commercial fishing opportunities in their region. From there, we got on a little tiny airplane down to the southern Pantanal, and that's where we got to see the amazing pockets of wet and dry and forest out the window of the airplane. It was amazing.
You don't just do this in an afternoon.
You sure do not. No, you can't even get to one place in an afternoon. We did this trip from north to south in about 10 days.
And the view from the air be very
stunning. It's really incredible to pass over a really pristine ecosystem, and so much so that you can do wildlife spotting from your airplane.
So describe the quality of these places. A lot of times when conservation groups want to work on an area, it's because bad things have happened and we're trying to fix it. What's the state of play in this region?
We're lucky because we're working on relatively intact and relatively conserved ecosystems. And that's really exciting because we're not talking about restoration. We're talking about being able to come in at a time when that ecosystem is still providing for the communities that live there.
Well, that means working, of course, with the people who live there. They're the ones who matter and the ones who know best.
we're talking about local communities, and especially in Bolivia, a large number of indigenous communities.
And for my colleague Natalia Araujo, who works on the ground in Bolivia and who we interviewed in the field for this episode, lasting conservation can't happen without the communities who call the region their home. Her team's approach focuses on collaborating with indigenous partners in the region and making sure their knowledge guides how their land is cared for.
La forma de trabajo es promover y fortalecer las capacidades locales y las voces locales, porque los pueblos indígenas son actores clave.
The approach is to promote and strengthen local capacities and local voices, because indigenous peoples are key stakeholders and owners of the territory.
Para que ellos puedan ser los gestores de este territorio.
And the initiative seeks to achieve the greatest possible strengthening of their customs so that they can be the stewards of this territory.
Our support is very much in capacity building, in helping planning so that these communities have the tools they need for ecosystem planning and for planning for their areas. And in Pantanal, one of the key groups that we work with is traditional landowners, and most of them in the Pantanal are ranchers. About 95% of the Pantanal is still privately owned, and so a key group for conservation and for sustainability is ranching.
So that's a little counterintuitive maybe to the American perspective, right? Ranchers, they have cattle, they tromp over stuff, not always great in some areas of the world. In this case, it's just the opposite.
It is the opposite. So the Pantanal is a seasonal floodplain where water comes for half of the year and it's flooded. And then for the other half of the year, it's really dry. And that seasonal difference really helps to regulate the environment and actually helps the cattle ranching operation be sustainable, because the ranchers are automatically rotating the cattle to different pastures because of the influx of water. We're talking about very few heads of cattle per acre, and that means that there's a very low density of cattle that's grazing on any particular piece of land. These are huge fields with open grazing. It's not the confinement that you think about when you think of a traditional U.S. cattle operation.
So the human presence that we're talking about is a good thing in this environment. Sometimes people coming into a place are seen as changing it, but people are already here. They're part of it all. What is the added benefit of the people being there?
The Pantanal has had continuous human presence in this cattle ranching style for close to 300 years. And ranching has been really beneficial in keeping the native vegetation intact, in keeping the native species there and part of the ecosystem. 85% of the Pantanal is still native vegetation. And so that means that these ranchers are not converting fields. They're not deforesting more than they need to support their operation. It means that they're one with the environment in the Pantanal.
In addition to cattle, there are a lot of other local species. What's the animal life there and what are they known for?
There are giant river otters, which are like 6 feet long. They're amazing. There's tapirs, the hyacinth macaw, and then, of course, the iconic jaguar, which is a huge draw for tourism.
Does the local community embrace ecotourism to see these jaguars?
There are certain regions of the Pantanal where there's really dense jaguar populations. There's a particular state park called Encuentro das Águas State Park, where they have one of the highest densities. And there, ecotourism for jaguars is one of the top economic drivers of the region. And then there are other areas where jaguars are less common, but they actually pose a bit of a threat and a bit of a problem to some of the ranching communities. As you can imagine, cattle might be a food source for a jaguar, right? And so there is this tension at times between the ranchers and the big cat conservationists. But there are a lot of solutions coming to light these days that will allow jaguars and the economic activity of cattle ranching to happen in unison.
Do you think part of that is helped by what we were talking about at the beginning, which is we're not taking a place that's been degraded. We're taking a place that's flourishing and its natural self, and people want to just keep that going and enhance it. So does that sort of mindset make some of the challenge easier to handle?
I think that we have a unique position where we're working for conservation rather than working for restoration of an ecosystem. The Pantanal as a whole is very well designed to support this collaboration between humans, between the plant species, between the animal species, between the hydrology. It being defined by those extremes of flooding and then dry season really helped to create this collaborative environment, and you have to work together in order to persevere there. I think the region is as a mosaic. So if you picture a mosaic full of little tiles that individually might not look like a lot, but you zoom out and you get the bigger picture of this amazing landscape. And that's very similar to what the Pantanal Gran Chaco can look like.
And is the future of this place tied to one side of the equation more than the other? Or is the great beauty of it that it is this interlocking thing?
The long-term success of the Pantanal and Gran Chaco as ecosystems really relies on protecting them both and protecting the entirety of those ecosystems.
Beyond the climate threats that so much of the world faces, are there any other specific threats that this region faces?
The greatest threats are actually pretty similar across Pantanal and Gran Chaco, and that shouldn't be surprising. They're adjacent ecosystems with a lot of shared interest. And the greatest threats right now are deforestation as a result of expanding and intensifying agriculture. And it's a particular problem in Bolivia, where soy is advancing more and more into the Gran Chaco. And the other issue is wildfires. They are a natural part of these ecosystems, but at the scale that they are happening and at the frequency that they are happening, it's becoming really difficult for the ecosystems to bounce back. Think of wildfires in California or in Canada that we've seen in recent news. Those kinds of devastating impacts are happening in Brazil and Bolivia. And so working to try and mitigate those threats is really important. And then the final threat is any threat to the hydrology of the region, of course, will have a really great impact downstream.
So underlying everything you've just described, the threats and how you respond to them, has to be the indigenous knowledge of the local communities. Are there examples of that you've come across that where you see the indigenous knowledge put to work?
Yeah. Pew supports the indigenous autonomous government of Charagua, Iambay, in Bolivia. And they have been so successful that in the 2024 fire season, the area that they were most monitoring and taking action to prevent wildfires did not burn, and all of the surrounding regions around it did. And that's a testament to how much knowledge that team already has and is already implementing and is having such huge success with just 1 year of fire training. And so thinking about that moving forward gives me a lot of hope.
And Amelia's sense of hope is echoed by Natalia.
Lo que más me gusta de trabajar en estos paisajes es disfrutar del entorno natural y, por supuesto, entrar en contacto con las distintas poblaciones y actores.
What I like most about working in these landscapes is enjoying the natural environment and, of course, working with the different populations.
Los gobiernos indígenas, el gobierno nacional y las otras
indigenous governments, the national government, and other institutions. Colleagues who are working in the field who are making incredible efforts to achieve change.
Todo esto te revitaliza, te llena de esperanza, y es realmente un placer tener la oportunidad principalmente de trabajar en territorio.
And all of this revitalizes you, fills you with hope, and it's truly a pleasure to have the opportunity, especially to work in the field.
Amelia, before we let you go, talk to people who have never been there, who probably won't get there. What would you tell those folks?
So I come from an environmental background. I'm really interested in conserving and protecting and engaging in sustainable practices to make sure that these beautiful, incredible ecosystems will be here for years to come. I'm getting to enjoy it, but I'd love for it to stay there for the next generation, for the one after that. I would encourage folks to think about the impact that just having these intact ecosystems can have, not just locally for these amazing communities, but for the world, for us on a global scale. Just knowing that these opportunities are there is beautiful.
Thanks for listening. To hear more stories like this, visit us at pewtrust.org/afterthefact. And if you have questions or feedback you'd like to share, you can write us at podcasts@pewtrust.org. You can also leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. For the Pew Charitable Trusts, I'm Dan LaDuke, and this is After the Fact.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN News team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchen, news intern Sylvia Thorpe, and news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening.